This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. My name is Armand Gildas, and I'm one of the hosts of the Anthropology Channel here at the New Books Network. Today, I have the greatest honor of hosting Elaine Oliphant to talk about her brilliant book, The Privilege of Being Banal, Art, Secularism, and Catholicism in Paris, which was published in 2021 by the University of Chicago Press. Let me introduce Elaine first. Elaine Oliphant is an assistant professor of anthropology and religious studies at New York University. She is interested in the tenacity of white Christian privilege in the West and has explored its reproduction through architectural forms, aesthetics, museums, and contemporary art. She has recently begun a new research project that addresses two questions, one historical and one contemporary. First, she is interested in exploring the historical role of the French Catholic Church in the shift from chattel slavery to racial capitalism in the French Caribbean in the mid-19th century. And second, she hopes to learn from present-day activism and aimed at reforming typical narratives of abolition and reparation in France. Well, I'm very excited about your new project as well. So without further ado, welcome to our podcast, Elaine.
Thank you so much, Armand. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Before I start with my questions, let me say how much I enjoyed reading The Privilege of Being Banal, not least because of its focus on the role of whiteness and Catholicism in France, as someone who works on whiteness in Germany. So my first question is, how did this book come about?
Thank you so much, Armand. I was delighted to see that we have so many overlapping interests. So the book came about in, you know, a mixture of very careful and very random ways. I had decided to focus on Paris when, in and around the urban riots, as they were called at the time, the protest movements that were happening in the banlieues of Paris in 2005. And although religion was not necessarily the focus of these protests, there was a lot of discussion within the French press about Muslim youth as being kind of responsible for this level of violence. and there was also the discussion of the banning of the headscarf in schools, and the kind of so-called threats to laïcité were really taking off at this period. And I just really was struck by the absence of any discussion of Catholicism in these conversations. And I thought, you know, when I think of France, I think about a lot of Catholic spaces. Catholicism hasn't vanished. What's going on here that it seems as though it doesn't need to be discussed. So I decided to pursue a project exploring that question. And I was wanting to kind of think about Catholicism beyond the space of the church, in public spaces, the publicity of religion as it's just defined in religious studies. But I was, you know, kind of fumbling around in my first few weeks trying to figure out where exactly I would find what I was looking for. And when I told him about my research, he said, "Well, why aren't you going to the Collège des Bernardins?" And I said, "What's that?" And he just sort of rolled his eyes at me as if I'd clearly not done my research well enough. And it was a brilliant suggestion. It was exactly what I was looking for. I sort of wandered into this really remarkable space one day and really didn't leave for another couple of years. So that's how I ended up at the Collège. Good luck.
I mean, I also hear a lot of fieldwork studies like this, that random happenings and things that come together in a wonderful way.
Yeah, I think, you know, religious studies scholars should have something to say about that in terms of, you know, this something out of nowhere. I was struck by a prophetic idea. There's a very kind of religious narrative that comes with all good ethnographic research.
Definitely. And what about the name, The Privilege of Banal? I mean, it's an interesting combination, but once you start reading the book, it becomes obvious what a to-the-point title it is. How does it capture your project for those who haven't read your book yet?
So the title of the book was, you know, it came late, in part because I had been stuck on a concept that I really realized wasn't doing work for me. The title had been Spaces of an Unmarked Faith. But I realized at a certain point that the unmarked really wasn't fully capturing what I wanted to say about the place of Catholicism in France. It's not just that Catholicism goes unmarked, it's that it's also able to leap out into the foreground in really, really powerful ways. And there's no example more powerful than the burning of the Notre Dame in 2019, which, you know, the world turned its gaze at this immense space and watched as it burned, and Parisians gathered along the banks of the Seine in a state of sincere mourning. And pundits on the radio and the television said, you know, this is the core of France. This is the essence of France. You know, what a tragedy to lose the center of France's soul. And none of this seemed to bring to mind the possibility that France's secularism or France's laïcité is an odd one, and not nearly so, and not one in which religion is absent. So how is it that Catholicism can often just blend into the background? Makes up a part of the rhythm of what's available at the bakeries and restaurants during the year. It defines the calendar. It takes up a great deal of the cityscape, but not in ways that are always noticed. But it can also be in ways that are monumental and powerfully present. And even though there is a widely held agreement that within that France's strict laïcité requires that all religions be absent from the public sphere, this is just in no way applies to Catholicism, which is given this incredible flexibility to move back and forth between the background and the foreground. And really any site of Islam receives so much attention and consternation. When the debates around the headscarf shift declined, then just concerns about niqabs became quite an obsessive concern in the media and public discourse. Then the burkinis, and at times I heard debates about, you know, the length of women's skirts. You know, were Muslim teenagers trying to sneak their religion into the public schools by wearing particularly long skirts? They're seeking out these signs of Islam in ways that were just and kind of crazy. Many of the streets and metro stations can be named for Catholic spaces and figures. And the Catholic infrastructure can just take over the landscape in ways that are just so powerful. It can populate the museums. Fine art is also Christian art in France. And Christian spaces take up really significant places in the ritual life of France. I turned ultimately to Hannah Arendt's concept of banal, in this meaning, not something that people feel nothing for or are detached from, but rather the capacity to act in ways that are held to be otherwise problematic or dangerous without really feeling the weight of that contradiction. So that was the way that why I settled on banality. I also wanted to identify that banality. When I first started, you know, using the words, some colleagues said, wow, aren't the people you studied going to be really offended that you're calling them banal? And I realized that I needed to really emphasize that it's banality is a, if you can occupy that space, it's a great privilege. It means that you can move in the world in ways that are deeply contradictory without feeling any repercussions for that. And later on in the book, I conclude by thinking about the banality of privilege itself. So I kind of turn the phrase around. But the core of the book is really thinking about just this privileged power to stand as nothing more and nothing less than France itself, within a form of laïcité that is often very strict and prohibiting the presence of other religious forms.
I mean, in a way, what you're talking about sounds a lot like, to me, like passing, right? Like that kind of privilege. And I mean, the question of unmarked and whiteness being unmarked is always like spoken in those terms, which actually ethnographically makes it very hard to actually study whiteness itself, because those tools aren't there if you keep reproducing the trope of whiteness being unmarked in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. No, white privilege is certainly the concept that I was using to in order to address how this is a privilege. I think there's a lot of pushback generally to think about, to use American concepts to talk about it, that have been developed to talk about American white supremacy, to take those and apply them to France is generally something I receive a lot of pushback about. But I think that it's a very productive concept, this way that power is not just, you know, a violent or its violence is not always explicit, but is often just in these everyday modes of kind of microaggressions, whereby one's life way is taken to be so naturalized and so significant, and therefore can't be questioned, while other life ways are dismissed and seen as deeply problematic and threatening to this core. And that's what white privilege really gets us to, and what I think is also happening in France and in and around different religious forms and in and around racial forms as well.
Hmm. And this also kind of, I mean, is a good leeway to talk about the difference between maybe secularism and laïcité. I mean, I'm kind of familiar with the discussion from the context of Turkey, but I'm very curious how it plays out in France. And to add to that, maybe you can talk a bit about catholicité.
Sure, yeah. So laïcité and secularism in the kind of Anglo-American style, the easiest distinction I've heard is that in the Anglo-American tradition of secularism, the emphasis is on the freedom of religion, that one should feel free to practice one's religion in public spaces. So kind of dating back to the Protestant Reformation, when many different Protestant groups were, you know, deemed heretical or problematic, or, you know, there were limits put on their practice. So different ideas of toleration now emphasize the right to religion, the freedom of religious practice. And the French tradition of laïcité emphasizes more the freedom from religion, and, you know, reason kind of thinking about the overwhelming power of the French Catholic Church or of the Catholic Church in a number of European countries in the early modern period, medieval period, the sense that religious power needs to be contained and limited and constrained so that people can circulate in public life without needing to engage in religious practice or be unduly influenced by religious ideas. But those are the kind of ideals of laïcité and secularism. And of course, the ways they work out in practice are far more complex and fragmented. And there's certainly lots of frustration and consternation expressed around the presence of religion in Anglo-American secularism. The appropriate place of religion, debates around where the Ten Commandments belong and whether accommodations should be made for a variety of religious practices. And similarly, in France, there is also debates and discussions about how the right to practice religion and how it should take up public space. So, but it does speak, I think that distinction does speak to something of the discursive frameworks under which they operate. So when I was in my first chapter, I try to address this, the place of the Collège des Bernardins, which is a 13th century monastery that was purchased, that had been expropriated during the French Revolution and then purchased back by the French Catholic Church and turned into a space for contemporary art display and intellectual debate. So it was trying to make this case that the distinction between Catholicism and elite secular French culture and heritage need not be so drawn so carefully. In fact, that the two merged together in really important and powerful ways, and Catholicism stood at the foundation of French elite cultural and intellectual life. And so in trying to understand how the kind of stakes involved in that kind of a claim, I looked at two different ways that we might see the kind of religion being produced in this space. And for the many of the people who initiated the project and were involved in its early years, they were attempting to build on this concept of what's called catholaïcité. So a bit of a pun that doesn't work as well in English, but Catholic secularism, that France, that France is, has a secularism with a Catholic flair to it, that there's, and that's certainly true in many respects. But what I also found when I went to do this work at the Collège is that there were many voices within the Collège who were worried that what that was going on in this space was the production of a secularized Catholicism, a Catholicism that had been tamed by secular strictures and that was operating in ways that reduced its distinctiveness, its moral authority, and its powerful voice to push back against the secular public sphere. And there was an ongoing debate within this space about what was being produced and the voices that were really pushing for a catholicité. I recognized that in many ways, when both those who were pushing catholicité and those worried about a secularized Catholicism, both were deeply invested in maintaining Catholicism's banal privilege, its right to occupy the public sphere in ways that were unquestioned. And the people who were pushing catholicité and creating the Collège in this very sophisticated way were really recognizing, you know, what would be the most effective way to reproduce that privilege. Not by making Catholicism stand out as yet another religion, but by insisting that by emphasizing its banality precisely, by emphasizing the way in which it could move back and forth, its moral voice could push out and then recede according to the needs of the time, but that would never become problematic or never become questioned. And the secularized Catholicism voices were worried about secularized Catholicism, you know, were saw this as a dangerous game, one that could force the Catholic voice to shape itself too much according to secular standards. And that part of what's significant about Catholicism is that it ought to stand out and ought to be distinctive. It shouldn't be just the same as going to any other museum or any other cultural event in Paris. So that's the debate I explore in the first chapter.
And what's the role of European Islam within these discussions?
So European Islam, it's sort of the specter that haunts much of the Collège and the practices that occur there. It's the religion that those pushing for the reproduction of catholicité. It's the negative example they want to avoid. They want to avoid being this religion that stands out. It's one of the many contradictions that and that power and motor Catholicism's privilege of banality, you know, from the way that its materiality can stand out. Well, its Muslim materiality must be hidden. One of the more significant that I found was the way that Muslim actors in France are often described as medieval in a very negative sense, pejorative sense. They're seen as kind of incapable of modern, of being modern and capable of having the right views about gender and sexuality, and not knowing and not understanding the nature of French political life, and so they many the wearing of the niqab, for example, is taken to be a medieval practice, one that prevents the subject that's kind of hidden within from developing the necessary agency that it comes with a modern self. And what I found so kind of remarkable about that language, in addition to its kind of racist and deeply problematic expressions, was that engaging with a space that was a medieval Catholic space in which the medieval was being celebrated as the core of French modernity and French culture and French heritage. And so many visitors were coming to like just wanting to step their toes where the medieval Cistercian monks had once stood and just stand near an old, what had been a water fountain, and imagine it filled with silent monks in prayer and doing, they really wanted to move in a way that they could access this medieval history in ways that were tangible. And again, that's, that contradiction, you know, carried no weight. Many people came having seen images on television and were convinced that there must be a cloister of some kind. And there wasn't. There was one long open room on the ground floor and a smaller sacristy. And if you opened the back door, it would just lead onto a beautiful 20th century swimming pool, indoor swimming pool. But so many people insisted that I open the back door and show them because they insisted that they'd seen it. There was a cloister. They'd seen it on TV. And I'd open the door and show them this beautiful 20th century pool. And that, you know, they would just be devastated. They said, I was sure it was there. And I was just really struck by that error that so many people made. They would see a few of the images and quickly a whole medieval landscape, monastic landscape developed in their minds, and they couldn't be convinced otherwise. So the positive valences of the medieval that accompanied the Catholic medieval compared to this deeply threatening supposed medieval Islam is a really significant contradiction. Islam, there is in one of the first chapters when I talk about, chapter three, when I talk about the first exhibit of contemporary art that I saw at the Collège, in which an artist had smashed tall panels of glass and burned a library of books and placed silenced bells on the floor of the building. People who came to see the Collège and were confronted by this very powerful and shocking exhibit often would suggest that this had been the work of Muslim vandals, just like in the 2005 riots, that this wasn't an artist, but a Muslim vandal who'd come to destroy the good neighborhoods, as they would put it.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
I mean, it's really interesting that, definitely like the specter of Islam haunting everything and everyone is present in Germany as well. But after Islam, the other kind of belief that stands out is definitely considered Catholicism here, at least among secular circles. So it's interesting. I was really thinking about this when I was reading the book as well, because apparently banality is also quite contextual in that sense.
I do think so. I mean, that's not to say that there aren't, very, very committed, deeply secular communist voices in France that, see this Catholic Church as always and forever a threat. There are, but that's a pretty significant, it's a minority of voices that would go that far. There is a general majority for whom Catholicism is neither a part of their daily lives nor a significant threat to those daily lives. But even if they don't see the Catholicism that is a part of their daily lives, it certainly does still shape so many of the cultural practices and a daily rhythms in which they engage. So there is certainly a large, even still today, 65% of French people describe themselves as Catholic, while only 4.5% go to mass regularly. So there's a huge swath of the population that engage with Catholicism in this partial, tacit way. So I do think that the concept of venality is one that can be mobile. It'll just look really different. It's one of the ways to help us think about the majority religion in any given place and how it gets to elide many of the strictures of secularism in ways that are not given to other religious forms. So Protestantism in the United States would more likely to occupy a space of privileged venality. And perhaps in Berlin and parts of northern Germany as well.
Yeah. And I mean, going back to that exhibition you were talking about, one of the things I found really inspiring about your book is the kind of multiplicity of sources you use. I mean, on one hand, your ethnographic observations in Paris, but more specifically working as a mediator in Collège with interviews, architectural readings, contemporary art exhibitions and their catalogs, art historical documents and books and official speeches, to name a few. So I want to ask, how was it to bring all of these together? And can you maybe tell us a bit about your ethnographic research?
Sure. The research came to take shape slowly. I was at first just attending events at the Collège and going on tours of it. And then I began to befriend some of the mediators of the first contemporary art exhibit who were my age and easy to talk to. They were students like myself. And the art exhibitions were clearly a site of a great deal of anxiety and tension and a lot of profound emotions. So I was drawn and pulled to just sort of hang around them as much as I could. And because I was the same age as many of the mediators, employees at the Collège kept mistaking me for a mediator. And then when the second exhibition began and the 2008 financial crisis had moved from the United States into Europe in profound ways, and the large budget with which the Collège had begun shrank significantly. And so while the first mediators had been full employees with benefits and a decent salary, they now needed to turn to interns, a different classification of employment where you don't make a living wage and you don't get additional benefits. So they had to fire all the first mediators and hire new ones. And at some point in that process, I got brought in as well. And it was a fantastic bit of luck to be able to be formally employed. I explained to them that I was continuing to conduct research. They were fine with that. But it just gave me a really different rhythm of ethnographic research in which I was really staying in one place day after day, long enough to really identify patterns, which I came to understand are really key for ethnographic research. It's not just that we're talking to people and getting sort of firsthand accounts. And I think interviews are one of the actually not always the most significant parts of ethnographic research. You also need to just overhear things and have a passing conversation and just sit back and observe or to feel what it's like to be in the presence of particular different kinds of objects over time. And it's actually the duration that I think makes ethnographic work so significant. Duration of being with people in a place over time allowed me to say when things that happened were unusual and what was typical. And so that was the way I really approached the research in that space. And this is in part because I wasn't really able to kind of follow the people that came in and out of it. they came to me, and I had these relatively brief interactions with them. With the employees, I had more long-term relationships, but I wasn't really going to their homes or meeting their families or, you know, tracing out their full humanity in any real way. The artists, I only met a few of them, and I had, you know, short-term encounters with them. The mediators were friends. We would occasionally hang out outside of the college, but I felt in many ways that in part because I was doing research among very privileged people, among very wealthy people. The visitors to the college were extraordinarily wealthy for the most part. And they really did not see any benefit to our having any kind of a relationship. There was nothing they could really gain from having an ethnographer follow them around. So even though I wanted to get a better sense of how this very privileged, wealthy, Catholic, white elite lived and circulated, I just wasn't going to get that kind of access. And so I struggled with that for a long time, even after returning. And what I came to understand was that, in reading the works of bell hooks and others, that there is a really powerful gap in empathy that has been built into scholarly work, where there's such an excess of understanding of white Christian life ways, so much material, archival, architectural, art historical, to just really, so that, you know, the visitors who could come to the college could really fully imagine what it might be to be a monastic, you know, a medieval monk in this space. And there are so many ways, as I said earlier, that these life ways are just so celebrated and taken for granted as natural and not in any way threatened. And so by actually not fully engaging with this population in their full humanity, I think that was maybe an important part of studying privilege, where you don't go out to sort of say, let's, you know, fully understand and celebrate this way of life. Instead, let's look at it in a partial way and see how it's producing these, you know, the tenaciousness of these narratives of privilege. How is it reproducing white supremacy? How is it reproducing this inequality and this power, rather than appreciating it in its fullness? And I really began to see the, you know, art historical work that I'd been reading to help me understand my work as a mediator as for more data about how Christian white privilege operates, and the history of museums, the exhibit catalogs, all of these things that go into amplifying the significance of white Christian elite culture. These were all data points, all different kinds of data that I had gathered over time that I needed to analyze and kind of treat in similar fashion. And so I wish I could say that I had gone in with this plan to kind of approach the ethnographic research of privileged groups in a way that would not emphasize their humanity. It was not my plan, but it was something that I reflected on, and the ethical implications of my research I reflected on a lot. And, you know, I think at first it was the awkwardness of having conversations with people that I didn't agree with, you know, listening to them say racist remarks and not knowing whether I should push back or say, ask for more so that I could analyze it better. But it's not only the ethics of the interaction itself that I think ethnographers and anthropologists need to address, but the ethics of what kind of picture of are you offering up in your analysis? Whose lives are you amplifying and whose lives are you overlooking? These are, I think, really important questions we need to ask ourselves when we're studying privilege. Because too often we can just use ethnography as a means of accidentally further amplifying life ways that are already given so much space to the detriment of others.
So my favorite passage in the book was where you talked about your positionality, and not only that, but wrote, and I'm quoting, the inequalities that structure the majority of ethnographic research tend to produce a situation in which the ethnographer has more wealth and power than those he or she is studying. This inequality can at times serve to facilitate ethnographers' entry into the lived experiences of those they research. In such relations of inequality, ethnographers are often able to access private spaces more often than not, private spaces such as homes. And if I may add, the visibility of this access to private spaces more often than not is considered the criteria for good or thick ethnography. So how do you see this inequality affecting or being affected by the current discussions on decolonizing anthropology?
Yeah, I think it's key. When I was first telling some mentors of mine that I was going to do this research in Paris, they kind of laughed at me and said, "Oh, you know, that's the research you do when you've got tenure and you're settled and you've got kids, and it's not that, you know, you have to go out and do that rough research in the wilds or the sort of general terminology that's used to describe what are in fact very often racialized distinctions and certainly serious distinctions in class and certain serious distinctions in privilege and wealth. I really was invested in doing ethnographies of privilege, but I wasn't thinking enough about the ethics of that. And as I've said in our last question, the ethics of amplifying life ways that are already celebrated to the at the expense of other life ways. And I needed to do more to think about that. And I'm glad that I had a chance to do so before completing the book, but I think I needed to go further. In terms of research among, when in the typical anthropological way in which the ethnographer is the one with the power and the wealth and is often white in working with different populations of color, I think it is that inequality that we really need to address, and that so much of really wonderful engaged anthropology or applied anthropology is trying to do, where instead of just showing up in spaces where one is given a pass because of one's wealth and whiteness and connections to powerful American institutions, one should be moving in ways that developing relationships where the research is being done collaboratively and in ways that really benefit the populations with whom one is engaging. And I don't know what that looks like. I've not made that attempt. And I know it's really, really arduous and difficult work. But I think it is a key thing that anthropologists have to do to successfully decolonize the discipline. And I think questions need to be asked about research on privileged populations as well. I took for granted that the ethnographic method was valuable in and of itself, and if I could understand any life way better by engaging in ethnographic research, then that was all I needed to do. But in recent years, I've really been forced to confront that that's a problematic approach, and we always need to be asking about the life ways we're amplifying and the inequalities we're taking for granted and benefiting from, and thereby reproducing.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. And going back to the collage and the book, I was especially intrigued by the way you brought discussions on religion to bear on the experience of contemporary art, especially employing the concept of immediacy. Could you tell a bit about that?
Sure. So within studies of Christianity, there's this phrase developed by Matthew Engelke, the problem of presence. And how is it that different Christian actors access God's presence, feel that presence? And there's lots of debates among Catholics and Protestants about the correct ways to do that. And that's it takes place in a space where there's fears about idolatry, about putting too much power into material objects, and fears also of imagining that one is hearing God, which is, nicely, seemingly immaterial, and yet how can one know whether or not the spirits that are being made present are good or bad, are godly or demonic. So this problem of presence, of accessing God, since the death of Jesus for Christians, whose presence is intangible and invisible. So how is that made tangible and visible? And there are a host of ways through relics, icons, sacraments, speaking in tongues, reading the Christian Bible. So a great deal of fantastic anthropological research has laid out just how complex these modes of mediation of making God present are. And what I wanted to do was to argue that there are similar fears and anxieties that accompany the viewing of art. Within the West, within Europe, there's similarly the specter of the fetish, of putting undue power and being kind of drawn in and captivated by material objects in ways that are problematic, or the, celebrating the skills of an artist who doesn't deserve that celebration, being taken in by a fraud or someone who's not an artist who's not doing art for the right reasons. And so I tried to talk about the way that, in particular with one installation piece called Salila, the artist had tried to address the relationship that people had with the space of the collège itself. So it's not only paintings on the wall, but architectural spaces that people engage with in ways that are very powerful and complex and develop these significant relationships with. So one thing that the artist wanted to do with their installation was call into question the ways that people took for granted that this was obviously a medieval space, that they could, access something else that is inaccessible. They could access the medieval past. They could bridge this gap between the present and the past by simply moving in this space. And I saw that as that desire for immediacy, that desire for kind of tangible proximity to the past as being relatable to that desire for tangible proximity to God. But I wondered at one of the things that we discuss in the anthropology of Christianity is whether immediacy is possible, or whether we always have to struggle with a gap. And if it's in fact productive to struggle with that gap and accept something less than perfect immediacy. And because then we can really recognize what is going on in terms of mediation. And so what the artist did was they built up scaffolding in the sacristy to build an additional floor into this quite tall space. And in so doing, they reproduced how the space had been structured when it had been a fire station while owned by the city of Paris for about a century. And they took down the large lights that had been hanging, and they put them on the stairs leading up to this third floor, this second floor. And the floor was right next to the windows, which are normally a kind of above sight line, when one's standing on the floor of the sacristy. And they did all of these things to kind of call attention to the madeness of the space and the fact that this was a recently renovated space, that architects had made choices, not all of them perhaps the best choices they could have made, and really refused people. You had to walk up these rickety metal steps to the top of a platform on scaffolding where plywood floors, you know, lay out before you. So really denying them this access to any kind of immediacy, forcing them to see the space as mediated. And it produced a great deal of outrage and frustration. And on the top of the platform on the plywood, they had laid out a sculpture in neon lights that they called a cellule, a cell. And they were pointing to the multiple meanings of the word cell, that it had served, you know, there are monks' cells, but there are also prison cells. And briefly, the college had served as a prison during the French Revolution, as well as being, you know, the basic fundamental element of biological life. So they, you know, the exhibit itself was made up of plywood, neon lights, and not much else. And so when people coming to look were told that they were going to go to an art exhibition, they were expecting objects whose value could also be seen immediately, right? That there's that a painting hanging on a wall, that is an object of value. So when we would, you know, when they would encounter the space that was denying them the immediacy they wanted in relation to the collège, they would often move around this platform in ways that were dangerous, and they broke many of the neon lights. And we would admonish them and say, you know, please be respectful, this is an art exhibit. And they would laugh and say, you know, there's nothing that of value that has been broken here. And they were kind of implying that it was the artists who were fetishizing things, the artists who were suggesting that something like plywood and neon lights could have some kind of implicit or ingrained immediate value, which of course is not what they were saying. But it's true that one of the neon sculptures, they did separate that out from the after the exhibit and sell it for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a few years later. So I just, you know, was struck by these competing fetishes and these constant concerns about who was engaging in fetishism, who was putting improper value in objects and practices that didn't merit it. And all of these desires for immediacy, whether people were coming to look for art that they could instantly connect to and recognize as art, or come to a medieval space and access the past in ways that were immediate. So I saw lots of overlap in those desires and those fears. So that's how I tried to get us to think about our relationship with art. I think it's not always self-evident how to engage, especially with contemporary art. And I think we should do more to celebrate that awkwardness and expect that our relationships with material objects will change over time, and that we will become invested in ways that are complicated. But to kind of move beyond, you know, fetish, commodity, or trash, you know, these seem to be our sort of a sacred object, commodity, fetish, and our refuse. But I really push back against new materialist paradigms that insist that the objects themselves have agency. I really want us to foreground the human object relationships and the human relationships that happen in and among objects, so that we can really understand the desires and anxieties that surround them, and so that we can start to really build more a richer vocabulary and richer understanding of the ways we connect to and are disgusted by the materiality we're surrounded by.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, reading the book, I was also quite surprised by the visceral reactions the audience members would give to artworks and even break them. To me, these are unimaginable things. It must have been very, very, you had the perfect position to look into that, because usually in art studies it's very difficult to work with audiences, and your work as a mediator enabled you, and yeah, that looked really, I mean, the end result is really amazing to read.
Thank you. Yeah, I was really lucky to be able to access viewer experiences. That is something that's really sorely lacking in the anthropology of art and in our history, certainly. But yes, it was, you know, it sounds like pretty easy ethnographic research, hanging out in a medieval space, watching contemporary, you know, hanging out with contemporary exhibitions in a medieval space. But it was very exhausting and often deeply unsettling work because the visitors were often so outraged by what they saw. And we were associated with the works by virtue of our labor. And people would just scream at us, really express so much anger. And often bringing people to tears after day, you know, day after day, being yelled at again and again and again. It was actually really exhausting and unsettling. There were days when I really didn't want to go to work again. it clarified for me that these. I think if I was initially trying to approach Catholic materiality with some suspicion and some distance and, you know, refuse its privileged banality, I really had to acknowledge that we develop relationships with material forms that we can't just say we need to get over and are problematic and, you know, we can destroy them. They are really complicated. And I myself became really attached to many of the contemporary art exhibits because I was having to defend them every day. And at first I wouldn't always understand them or know how to talk about them. And it was often took me several weeks and to find the vocabulary I needed to convey what was going on with the works. But over the course of months, I would certainly become quite affectionate towards these spaces. And I often think about the installations and then I miss them. Or, you know, whatever that says.
I worked as an exhibition assistant in many contemporary art exhibitions in Turkey, so I definitely can relate to that. Thank you so much for joining us, Elaine. This was a very, very pleasure.
Thank you.
And I look forward to our paths crossing again.
Me too. Best of luck.
Thank you. This was the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Armand Yıldız. Until next time.